Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and this is All of It. And listeners, we just, you know, wanted to let you know that our next interview may cover topics related to addiction, drug use, and suicide, and may not be suitable for all listeners. So for the average person who might not know much about surfing, the connection between surfing and addiction might not be an obvious one. We might think of surfing, you know, and its tropey relationship to psychedelic drugs, you know, stemming from pop cultural stereotypes of the sport, you know, or however, when one begins to think of the adrenaline of surfing, you know, the constant pull to return to the waves, the connection isn't that hard to make. Our next guest, author and professor and surfer, Thad Sulkowski, is keenly familiar with both addiction and surfing, and he's explored their relationship, as well as how surfing can potentially be a way to understand addiction and, you know, approach recovery from it in his new book, The Drop. In The Drop, Sulkowski explores both how his history with addiction, his own struggles, as well as those of his friends, brother, and stepfather, and also how addiction is intrinsically related to surfing. Through both drug use and the gripping nature of the sport itself, addiction has seeped its way into the sport from early on. And Sulkowski explores in sections recounting the lives and experiences of famous surfers and their struggles. We're happy to welcome Thad Sulkowski on All of It today. Thad, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to ask you, as someone who has experienced addiction and is a surfer, when did the connection between surfing and addiction become apparent to you?
Well, I learned to surf when I was 10. And I was immediately kind of struck by how it eclipsed everything else. You know, I played other sports. I liked to read. And, you know, when the waves came up, everything was put on the back burner. And this kind of struck me in itself as really like a very powerful connection that was trumped everything else around me. I never saw anyone else, you know, kind of forego surfing. All the surfers went surfing when the waves came up, and they dropped everything else, including school. And that was the beginning of my sense of it as an addiction. There were a lot of drugs around in the, at the time. This is the early 70s. And drugs are connected to surfing in a kind of circumstantial way, but surfing in its own right has an addictive capacity. I mean, learning to surf when I was 10 had the same basic neurochemical signature as acquiring an addiction. It had risk, novelty, intense pleasure, dopamine, huge floods of dopamine, adrenaline, endorphins from the kind of physical demands of it. So that's the kind of striking thing about surfing viewed from the brain, at the level of the brain.
It's interesting because it's so hard, right? I mean, you obviously talk about how satisfying it is, but even at the beginning of the book, you know, you talk about an outing with your kids and you talk about your daughter falling over and over and over again into the water. Would that not get in the way of getting kind of addicted to it, or does that, you know, just help?
That's a great question. I mean, the way surfing works is that it tends to weed out people who don't really need it and don't have that obsessive, you know, repetition compulsion aspect. So in my case, I had a kind of ominous stepfather. My parents had recently divorced, and I had a sense of surfing as a refuge. So I was going to learn to surf. I was determined. It had held me because of the wilderness aspect that I had always been drawn to the woods as a boy. And so this is another form of wilderness for me. And the difficulty, like in the mechanical sense and the timing and the physical demands, just made it more compelling in a funny way. But I think that surfing attracts and holds people who have some degree of trauma, and they're finding relief and absorption in surfing. It's extremely demanding. It's absorbing because the brain is basically on high alert at all times. So it's very difficult to think of anything else when you're surfing, because the brain is basically thinking you might drown. You know, there are a lot of alarm signals going off at a subtle level. Even though we're kind of aquatic, you know, as we all swim, or most of us swim, it's not where we really are naturally suited. So there's a sense of foreignness that keeps you on high alert in a kind of low-key way, and that is really attractive for someone who's trying to overcome some degree of trauma.
So the book itself not only investigates addiction on a technical level, but, you know, it also explores your own life in relation to addiction, as well as the stories of famous surfers and how their lives were impacted by addiction, you know, from Andy Irons to Lynn Boyer. How did you decide to approach the topic in this way, you know, and what did you hope to achieve with the overlap between memoir and kind of this more technical investigation?
Well, I think, you know, surfers tend to see themselves as just kind of one tribe. And so I felt a really intimate connection to all surfers in a kind of like essential way. So Lynn Boyer or Tom Carroll or Andy Irons, they felt like very close to me at the level of their, you know, love of surfing. And I also acquired an addiction to alcohol and cocaine and other drugs in my 20s when I had quit surfing. And so, you know, just reading more about this, about surf history and paying attention to surf media over the years, it's just been really obvious and striking how many surfers, especially top competitive surfers, have struggled with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. It was actually very surprising for me to learn that as well, because it seems like it is such a demanding sport that addiction would just get in the way of it in a very kind of technical and physical way, but that isn't the case.
Right. I mean, most of what happens with addiction and surfing is not on the beach, you know, or at a bar or something. It's not like, I think what surfing does is it gives you a sense of attachment to a thrill. And so the kind of tragedy of surfing, in a way, and the tragedy of surfing in the lives of these top competitors, is that it's not enough. You know, and that's a very addictive kind of conclusion. It's whatever you're doing, it's not quite enough. Surfing can lead into addiction, but it can also lead out of it. So Andy Irons, for instance, was pulling himself out of addiction when he died of an overdose. He had kind of relapsed, but it was surfing that was helping him out. And another example of that would be Jeff Hackman, who had a really long and brutal heroin addiction for like 15 years, and now is alive and well and living on Kauai and surfing. And it's surfing that keeps him, you know, wanting to be healthy, wanting to be fit, wanting to stay sober, because he loves it so much. And surfing in that way is an interesting addiction because it straddles. It's kind of like, you know, if you see addictions as falling across a spectrum with, like, say, meth or opioid and kind of completely destructive addictions on one end of the spectrum, surfing's kind of in the middle because it allows you to feel the adrenaline and the thrill, but it's also very healthy and salubrious, and it does demand, like you were suggesting, a lot of physical fitness. But no, that's not to say that if you're in your 20s, you can't also develop a really, you know, bad drug habit on the side.
If you're just
keep
joining,
winning.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Thads Sulkowski, author of a new book called The Drop: How the Most Addictive Sport Can Help Us Understand Addiction and Recovery. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and you're listening to All of It. Thad, if you feel comfortable with it, could you describe your own personal experience with addiction?
Right. So I had an early scare when I was like 11 years old. I got very high on pot with some older surfers, and I was basically just panicked, you know, and I swore off everything for most of my adolescence until I was, you know, late adolescence. I drank a bit. And then in order to focus on my schoolwork in college, I quit surfing altogether, quit it like a drug. You know, I realized how powerful it was. And so I went to undergraduate, and then I went to spend a long time. I spent like 8 years in graduate school. And during all those times, all those years, I wasn't surfing, but I was sort of slowly acquiring an addiction to alcohol and cocaine. And this was something that was valorized more in the realm of the arts, which was what I was involved in, poetry and writing art criticism. And there's a kind of tradition of intoxicants in the world of art where it's got more of a kind of familiar and even, you know, kind of privileged status. But in surfing, that's not true. Surfing is ashamed of its, you know, drug addictions. It is what it seems to be by and large. It's healthy. It's yoga adjacent. But it has this deep kind of hold. It has this power to hold and to lead to other things. So in order to get sober, one of the things that really what I found helped me was to start surfing again. Hmm. And that came, it wasn't just a pure, you know, benefit. It also distracted me from what I was doing. It made me want to leave New York and go to live in Hawaii. Hmm. You know, it had a disruptive element. But what it did is it put me back in touch with an original joy, my boyhood joy. And that was something I completely lost touch with as an addict and as an adult, really. So what I vowed, and you know, I'm 61 now. I feel today what I felt when I was 10 years old, when the surf gets good, you know. Hmm. There's no difference to me. I feel that same intense pleasure and happiness and ecstasy when I'm in the water that I did when I was 10. And that's saying something, you know, that's a very powerful thing. So I think that surfing that's what it did for me, was to lead me, it gave me something to come back to.
Do you feel differently, or has your perspective on addiction changed after writing this book?
Yeah, you know, I had to do a lot of brain research for this, and I didn't know much about that. And it made me feel more, less in a way humanistic. You know, I feel more kind of, I can see the basic biomechanistic aspect of myself. You know, I'm like, you have a brain that has its chemistry, addiction. The kind of most progressive positions on addiction now are very oriented toward the brain and the disconnect between the prefrontal cortex and the motivational core, as it's called, the more primitive part of our brain that's about flight. So I feel in a way liberated from taking a certain, I think, mistaken degree of responsibility for it, you know, like a kind of taking too much, you know, because I feel now kind of humbled by the fact that I'm in this body that has real limits and can be dysregulated through excess, you know, like that the price of drinking a lot, or the price of doing a lot of cocaine, can be that your brain is actually dysregulated. I hadn't thought of it that way at all before I wrote this book.
One of the stories we heard a lot during this pandemic was just how hard the isolation and the restrictions were for people suffering from addiction. I wonder if that is something you thought about. I wonder if it's something you went through during this pandemic. What was your solace during, you know, this past year?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the theme of isolation is a big one in the book, and it has to do with just the kind of civilizational place we're in as a culture now is like this kind of really brutal individualism. You know, so everyone's got to be their own little brand, their own little entrepreneurial self, and guard that originality and kind of promote it. And I think that in itself is very isolating. And I think surfing helps me overcome that. But what I felt in the pandemic was actually kind of bliss, because I was able to write this book full on. And I was able to indulge a kind of hermit side of myself and not go out and not see people, which gave me like tremendous focus. So I didn't feel the isolation because I was finishing the book. But isolation as such is something the book is all about. There are a lot of reflections on that feature of existence, which I think is absolutely a cornerstone of addiction, you know, isolation, loneliness.
Yeah. In your book, you discuss, you know, the difference between kind of the solitary, lonely, professional surfing life versus, you know, the less competitive, more communal approach to surfing that could aid with addiction. So what are the qualities that set these two mindsets and approaches to surfing apart?
Well, you know, it's funny because in the pro world, you see people come up as kind of gangs. Like Andy Irons grew up in Kauai and on the North Shore, and he had a gang. You know, he had like a bunch of guys, and they all competed together, and they all surfed Pipeline together, and they all watched each other's back. And then as the pro, as they grew into their 20s and went on the pro tour, Andy Irons rose. He rose rapidly, became a, you know, three-time back-to-back world champion. His buddies back in Kauai and in the North Shore didn't do it for him anymore, right? So he's growing up, but he's also getting more isolated. he's lost his gang. And what has done that is just the corporate competitive arena, right? He's been separated from them and held up as a kind of, you know, god, but he's also lost his community. And he talks about this explicitly. And that, to me, is, I see that over and over again in competitive surfing, is the kind of loss of the gang, the loss of the community in favor of the isolation of, you know, achievement. And that often does lead to addiction right there. That isolation is when his addiction came on full blown, the pressure and the loss of his community.
I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with author Thad Sulkowski about his new book called The Drop, How the Most Addictive Sport Can Help Us Understand Addiction and Recovery. Thad, I want to read a little bit of the book because there's a chapter where you describe surfing as therapy, and this is specifically of you working with people with PTSD and veterans, and you write about going into the water, quote, "The land-based self dies a little on entering the ocean. It is diminished, forced to acknowledge its inexpertise and minority, to submit to oceanic laws. Everyone benefits from this humbling process, but for people suffering from PTSD or addiction, the weakening of the grip on the familiar managerial ego is especially good." Can you expand on this thought and feeling?
Sure, yeah. There's a, you know, when someone's traumatized, a war veteran, like a combat soldier, something blows up, they're blown up, you know, something horrible happens, the brain loops that trauma over and over to try to figure it out. I mean, this is one way to think about trauma. It's repeating itself. It's repeating itself. And the person suffering from PTSD tries to alleviate that by drugs, whatever they can do that's going to silence it. But the entering into the water for the veterans puts them on this sort of foreign footing, and they have to kind of readjust to those oceanic laws to be in the surf, and they're also shaken by a wipeout. So what happens is there's a little gap that opens up, and the trauma is kind of put on hold, the looping of the brain. A new thought can occur. A new experience can be kind of written into the brain in the synaptic level. And this is why it's so good for people with trauma surfing. That's why it works for for veterans learning to surf, is it because it gives you that break. It forces a break to occur because of the present-mindedness that surfing demands. And also just, I think, the physical shaking. So when I was out there surfing in California with these veterans, they would wipe out. And I knew what they were going through underwater. They're being rolled, you know, they're being shaken like a rag doll. And that's a good thing. You know, they come up and they're kind of clear-headed. They're wide-eyed. They survive something. There's a kind of gap. And then that gap, they're talking maybe to their instructor. They're talking perhaps about their experience. And so surfing has a lot of therapeutic dimensions to it that are being exploited now by these organizations, surf therapy organizations. But I think the other thing that comes up for addiction is just that awe, the awe you feel in the wilderness, and the ocean is a wilderness, is basically an experience of being small in a good way. Addiction is of the ego and the self getting large and you know, and kind of voracious and insatiable. And that's not good, right? That's why people who know addicts know them as selfish. And so for an addict in recovery to go into the wilderness, to go into the ocean, is to feel awe again. And that's just a salubrious kind of thing. That really helps.
It's so interesting just you mentioning, you know, PTSD, because I wouldn't automatically think, you know, what's really good for someone with PTSD? Just take a very scary tumble in the ocean. But you say that it's actually good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's part of how shock therapy in a kind of mild way works. You know, it shakes. It shakes the brain out of a pattern of depression or a cycling. That basic idea was known to the ancients. They would use herbs to kind of create a kind of seizure in someone suffering from psychosis of some kind. And the ocean reproduces that with a wipeout, you know, in its mild way, in its kind of fizzy way. That recurs in the ocean, and it's great. It's great for us.
You also discuss in the book that, you know, the importance of Hawaiian culture to surfing and the history of the sport. In particular, when discussing surfer Montgomery Ernest Thomas Kalukalani, or better known as Buttons, he was half Black and half Hawaiian. And you talk about how this cultural background influenced his relationship with addiction. Can you expand on Button's story and what he might be able to take, you know, from the cultural origins of surfing and, you know, apply that to addiction?
Yeah, Buttons was a really brilliant, electrifyingly spontaneous surfer. He was like just incredibly gifted and a kind of free spirit, and everyone loved him. And everyone was shocked later to learn that he had slipped into meth and heroin addiction. And he pulled out of it toward the end of his life through a very weird way. He had basically disappeared from the surf scene, from the pro scene, and he appeared on a reality TV show called Dog the Bounty Hunter. And he was found as having jumped bail and sort of dragged out of this van in a parking lot where he was doing heroin, and he got sober. And when he got sober, he got back in touch with his mother's side. His father was African-American. His mother was Hawaiian. And his mother's side of the family came from the North Shore and from also from Hawaiian cowboys and, you know, kind of rancher families. And his sense of himself as having a lineage in Hawaii was one of the things he talked a lot about in recovery as a sober, you know, and fully fit surfer again. He just kind of had a complete rebirth toward the end of his life. He died of lung cancer pretty young, in his early 50s. But I was very aware of his seeing himself as in a continuum, historical and cultural continuum with Hawaii, because what that does is put him in time and in an arc. And a lot of what addiction occurs often when we're decontextualized, we're yanked out of a sense of history, of self, of place. You know, you see addiction happen really in a kind of culture-wide way, and in cultures that have been decimated or defeated. And Hawaii is, you know, a post-colonial world, and he was rebuilding. He was of the age to have known a lot about the sovereignty movement in Hawaii, and his sense of connection was one of also of resistance, right, to colonialism, and that gave him a sense of strength that he hadn't had before.
You know, so we're talking about Buttons again, half Black and half Hawaiian, but in the U.S., you know, is surfing? It seems to be a kind of homogenous sport, you know, very white and very male, right?
Right, it does. It does less so now, less and less so. There are a lot of women surfers, especially out here in Rockaway, women surfers of color, more men surfers of color. That's happening. That's changing the kind of demographics of surfing. So that's all for the good. But predominantly, it's still, you know, white and male and young. I mean, I'm strange to be 61 in the water. You know, I don't see many people my age. So it's still pretty young, pretty white and pretty male. But like I say, that's changing. It's also changing because I learned when I was 10, and I came up in a kind of classic arc of, you know, hazing and, you know, clawing my way up some kind of hierarchy in the lineup. And now people start in their 30s, you know, and they surf in a different way, and they bring a different sort of intelligence and kind of forgiving quality to surfing, which is not usually culturally very forgiving. So that's been great, and I love all those recent things. It's changed quite a bit in the last 20 years in that respect. So
it is
not essentially blonde and blue-eyed, you know.
Yeah.
If anything, it's Hawaiian. It's Polynesian. and brown-skinned. But that's one of those histories that's kind of being reasserted all the time, and it's contested, right?
Yeah. Is it ever too late, I mean, to start surfing? Obviously, you say you're 61, but you've been doing this for a long time. You know, I'm 33. Am I too old to
right.
learn?
Absolutely not. No, you can learn. It's just the thing that you won't have that I had is all the time in the world, right? You know, and you can just devote yourself, and surfing kind of demands a certain degree of devotion. So maybe you'll never really get beyond a certain level, but you'll benefit from all these other things that surfing gives, like all the integrative things that surfing, the joy, and all that can be done even though you may not become a serious hardcore surfer. And that's the thing that's changing as adults, culture worker types start to surf in their 30s. You can start to surfing is gentle too. It's not like squash or something like where it's really hard on your legs or your knees. It's gentle. And there are forms like stand-up paddleboard that are even gentler than conventional surfing. So, you know, I think you can start at any age. There are all sorts of, you know, levels, but the fundamental feeling, the magic of gliding along on a wave, that's something you can feel even body surfing, you know. The essential thing is just to be picked up and kind of borne forward on this water energy. And however that happens and however you look and whatever level you are, you feel that, you know.
And, you know, on a final note, what piece of advice would you give to a beginner surfer, you know, whether they're 5 or whether they're 50 years old?
I would say just surf off to one side of the crowds. You can do that, especially on the East Coast. There's no reason to be surfing in a crowd and being a danger to yourself and others. That's the main thing. That's why there's a kind of harshness to surfing, because it's about safety. And you don't want to be put in danger by someone who can't control their board or whatnot. And so I think the best thing is just to surf with a friend off to one side. And I also think for recovering addicts, it's best to surf in a sort of solitary way. It can be very meditative and soul searching. Surfing, you know, any experience of the wilderness can be that. But I think that surfing has this beauty that's experienced best in solitude in a way, which you can, like, as I say, you can find around here in the East Coast.
Thank you so much. So I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and I've been speaking with author Thad Sulkowski about his new book called The Drop, How the Most Addictive Sport Can Help Us Understand Addiction and Recovery. Thad, thank you for joining us on All of It.
Well, thank you for having me, Rebecca.